Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Maleficent and the Addams Family, starting off with Maleficent, Mistress of Evil. You know, this was all Angelina Jolie. You know, the whole movie really revolves around her. And the makeup and costuming is out of this world. I think that is the pinnacle in terms of what I saw in the movie. And by the way, I saw that in 3D as well.
I think this is an example of where if there's an Academy Award nomination, it's for best acting with high cheekbones
yes.
and high horns. She's really striking. And
yes.
However one feels about the film otherwise, she's riveting when she's on screen. And it's a combination of her natural beauty, but also really gifted work with prosthetics and makeup and whatever else. And so we're always talking about what are likely Oscar nominations. And I think certainly in terms of makeup and costume design and things like that, they really have her done up just right. She's one of the co-producers of the film, so I think she had something to do with that. And she's been away from the screen pretty much for recent years, so it's kind of nice to have her back in a starring role.
I was impressed enough with makeup to look it up. So it was Arjun Tweetin, who did the makeup for Pan's Labyrinth.
Ooh, a film I love.
Yes, and if not for no other reason than the fabulous way it looks.
I love it for many, many reasons, but that's one of them, yeah.
Yeah, it really creates a very believable dark underworld.
Exactly.
And, you know, you can just see her coming from that same sort of place. The costume designer is Ellen Morozhinnik. And I did think that the costuming was incredible, except for the crowns. I thought the crowns looked incredibly cheap. Almost like they took Burger King crowns and just spray painted them silver.
Yeah, they were kind of tinny looking.
Yeah.
I was surprised by that. I mean, you know, there are palaces that you know, are really impressive structures, and you have a full staff there and all that, and nice costumes. And then the crowns just seem kind of tinny.
The dollar store.
Yeah, they did actually. Maybe the money ran out at that point. I don't know. You know, I'm not sure I'd want to wear the crown. No thanks.
Well, you know, part of the enjoyment of movies like this is the kind of classic fairy tale story coming to life. And really, it's supposed to enhance the idea of Sleeping Beauty. By the way, this is to be released on the 60th anniversary of the original Sleeping Beauty. But one of the things I thought did not work for me was that the Aurora character is so classically a Disney princess, she almost doesn't even register. I was much happier when Angelina Jolie was on screen because, if nothing else, she's just amazing to look at. And you could cut glass with those cheekbones.
She does.
but the regular characters of the Sleeping Beauty, you know, original story,
yeah.
Really very bland.
Yeah, in fact, I want to go on a rant against this
go
film.
Go for it.
Okay, so the first film came out in 2014. And the sequel comes out, you know, 5 years later. It opened, we're speaking just after the opening weekend, it opened relatively modestly. Not bad, but not as much as they had hoped for. And a lot of the speculation is that when you make big franchise or would-be franchise films, you can't let too many years go by between installments. So, you know, to let 5 years go by, typically they try to let, you know, if they're fast, 1 year, but usually about 2 year intervals, right? So to go 5 years, that somehow the public either forgot or had sort of a meh feeling about, whatever, but didn't turn out in huge numbers. I mean, enough that it was respectable, but not what the first film did. But that's just box office reporting. But in terms of, so that was slightly disappointing, let's put it that way. But the disappointment on a creative level is something I thought about as I was watching it. And then I'm always saying negative things and going on rants. And so what I thought I'd do is a quote an extended rant from somebody else.
Okay.
So it gets pinned on her, not on me. But when the film opened, Manola Dargis, one of the film critics for the New York Times, referred to it as the unhappy reactionary sequel. And if you'll indulge me with, you know, an extended quote from her, I think she really nails it. And she's much more articulate than I could be in this respect. So here's the quote. If Mistress of Evil, and that's the sequel we're talking about, if Mistress of Evil had any of the predecessors' flashes of self-aware humor, embellished beauty, or basic filmmaking intelligence, it would be easier to take or at least ignore. But it's a clotted mess. It's also dispiriting because it has traded a fairy tale about female solidarity for a war movie about what happens when women assume power. It opens with a bent knee and ends with an ever-after kiss, but much of the rest is a convoluted brawl filled with noise and computer minions who are tossed like darts. At center is a grasping, malignant... See, it's such an extended quote, I have it in book form. At the center is a malignant queen. She's played by Michelle Pfeiffer. The very stereotype that the first movie rejected. Female villains have long been useful scapegoats, repositories for social and cultural anxieties about men, women, and power. The original Maleficent pushes against that stereotype with a protagonist who's at once hero and villain, which means that she's finally neither. Much like Frozen, it insists that women can be complex and that even a princess does not need a prince to justify her life. Women can work together, love one another, and find their own way. In 2014, when Maleficent, rather than the prince, delivered the kiss that roused Aurora, it felt like an awakening. This new flick does not just feel like a retreat, it also feels like a poisoned, candied invitation to sleep.
Wow.
So what do you think?
I think that is extremely well written and true.
That's why, begging the indulgence to quote at such length, I mean, it really nails it. That the first film had a kind of freshness and of its moment and in terms of, that sort of empowerment. This film does seem reactionary. It seems like a kind of retrenchment. It's playing safe, but safe in the sense of, we have a war and we have all these computer-generated fairies and monsters and whatever else having at each other. And, I'll watch it. I mean, it's not boring to watch those scenes, certainly. But by the same token, it doesn't seem to have enough sense of character. And you were referring to that earlier with Aurora and with some of the other characters. They're almost not there.
Mm-hmm. Even the fairies.
Yes, but well, fairies are almost not there anyway.
But I mean, the three fairies who were original. Juno Temple, and Imelda Staunton.
Yeah, they seem marginal, don't they?
They do.
They literally flit in and out, and they're so small and insignificant. I had to remind myself these are actors I care about, but they seem so unsubstantial.
Underwritten.
Underwritten. They don't really do much. They just kind of flit around, and they're meant like it's kind of a kind of adornment or embroidery on the action. They don't really contribute to it.
And the prince.
Oh, there was a prince.
Polite, nice person.
Really
but
bland.
Really bland.
Really bland.
Not even, exceptionally pretty. Because let's face it, Michelle Pfeiffer, amazing.
Do you know
gorgeous.
What? Oh, my God. I've always liked her as an actor. And this goes back to like early 1980s. And friends of mine would say she's one of the most beautiful actresses mm-hmm. in Hollywood. And to see her in this, she looks wonderful.
Wonderful.
Oh, she looks great. And she's playing a heavy. She's playing a bad character, if you will. But she's so beautiful. And it's such a controlled performance. That at the point where, she doesn't even hide behind any sense of politesse and she's just out and out, power hungry and mean and this and that. She lets loose that way, but again, with a kind of restraint, a kind of control that actually is all the more frightening because she keeps herself totally under control. Meantime, she's going to run that kingdom, whatever she has to do to her husband, the king, or anyone else, right? She's going to be in charge there. And it really elevates the film to the extent that it's elevated, that when she's on the scene, if anyone can hold her own with Angelina Jolie, she can. And so there really are some good, I was about to say mano a mano, but
yes.
there's some good one-on-one action scenes there. And again, that's just partly a matter of the physicality of it, that both of them really, really hold the frame. And they're both really good actors in these scenes. And the characters as written aren't much, frankly, but in performance, when the two of them go at it, it's fun to watch.
And they gave Michelle Pfeiffer some fantastic outfits to wear.
Oh, she looks great.
She looks great. And Angelina Jolie looks great. And most of the time, Elle Fanning looks great. And then you have this sort of, it's like they went home early on the day they were casting for the prince.
People talk about central casting, this is in the pejorative sense that, you need him to be handsome. Well, he's more or less
okay,
handsome. He's
yeah.
okay looking. You wouldn't toss him out on a cold night, looks okay. Looks okay. But, not much by way of performance. Even in terms of the appearance, it's like you want it to be like drop-dead handsome, right?
Right.
And he's just basically sort of generically handsome.
He's supposed to hold his own with Angelina Jolie and Michelle Pfeiffer on
the screen. Yeah. And it doesn't quite work that way.
And they gave the king a cheap Burger King crown.
He does have a lousy crown. I got to tell you, he gets a raw deal anyway you look at it in this film. Again, without saying exactly what happens to the king, he gets kind of a raw deal here. But yeah, even the crown looks. I know we keep harping on that crown, but you know, there are important scenes taking place in a castle, right? And hundreds of people gathered, and somebody wearing the crown walks down the aisle. You're going to pay attention to that, right?
I also thought it was sort of a weak trope to go back to, well, let's invite the person and then make them really uncomfortable. So why would you serve a person who has wings, a bird, and then why would you then say something about, well, I guess you can eat it with your fingers?
Well, you know, people have really unusual allergies in this film. It's an allergy film, actually. So, you know, Maleficent, Mistress of Evil, she's allergic to iron, right?
All fairies are.
Well, yes, this is crucial fairy history.
Yes.
So anyway, like if you're serving a meal, you know, you go to pick up the fork and, of course, you know, and utensils, you know, that she'd be allergic to that. So it'd be okay to eat with her hands. But then, you know, other people are allergic to, you know, to flowers, right?
Right.
And so everyone's got an allergy here. And I just think it's like, you know, you need like warning labels for everything. You know, there may be peanuts in this product, you know. It's that kind of thing where this real sensitivity to all these allergies. So in terms of courtly etiquette, it causes some problems there. But you're right, in terms of plausibility, like if you're inviting like your prospective in-laws over for a big getting to know you dinner, and you have all the resources of a palace. I mean, this is like Downton Abbey times 10, you know, in terms of what you can summon up. Why you wouldn't have thought of that beforehand? It's a serious breach of etiquette.
Yeah, it's just a weird thing to bring in. It's like, you know, I don't know. It's an old kind of story, you know, to bring in the outsider and then make them uncomfortable, especially if you think they might turn violent.
Which is not spoiling anything, certainly does happen. Talk about a dinner party gone wrong.
Now, you know, I will say it would have been a better movie if they had just concentrated on Maleficent, like the sequel. So she had to go on. You know, her charge grew up, went on to, what do you do? You know, post, after, you know, and then they lived happily ever after. But what happened to Maleficent?
Well, that's true, because to put it mildly, she's not exactly outgoing with her warmer emotions. And so what within the plot would help to pull that out? And this film does that, but it would be nice actually to have more quality and quantity scenes by way of spending some time with her that way, because she's clearly got a kind of wrestling match inside of herself as to how she feels about her ward going off potentially to a new life and how she feels about various things. And this is where it's a plus and a minus that Jolie has that strong face, because some of the shots just rely on that, like strike a pose kind of thing, right? And you don't really get as much sense of an inner life as you might want. One could argue she maybe doesn't have that rich an inner life. That's not an argument I'm making. One could make that argument. But in any event, that you don't have much emoting. And a film that runs, you know, just under 2 hours, so you could easily have a few scenes there where, like, some quiet time, Maleficent by herself, sitting and moping and thinking or whatever. I mean, you can contrive a scene like that readily, and that would give Jolie more of a chance to act. I mean, real acting, not just striking a pose acting. And that would be quite interesting. And you could have the equivalent scenes actually from Michelle Pfeiffer. You know, what I call quiet time scenes, where you really get a sense of the actor and the character. And potentially that would make it a bit richer. And then when they square off, then when you have the mano a mano battles, there's not just the special effects that will dazzle you there, but it's also that you have characters with some substance and not just the facade, the veneer, which beautiful as it might be, that they present as they fight with each other. It is kind of funny to think about these two great beauties squaring off and fighting,
yes,
right? Like, you know, the ultimate cat fight. Like, please, you know, whatever you do, don't scratch the face.
Right, right. Well, I think that there will probably not be a Maleficent 3.
Well, never say never, because sequelitis is, speaking of unusual diseases and so on, I mean, you know, this one had a really big budget. That's the scary thing. It was like $180 million budget or something, and it may or may not eventually make that back. So I tend to agree with you, there might not be a third one. But, you know, they can always reboot things like this. You know, you can always have, if not all the characters, at least some of them. Because after all, when you have Sleeping Beauty type material, that's been rebooted so often through the centuries that I think this will be rebooted in some form.
You know, the first one, or I should say the one that came out in 2014, actually had her daughter in it in a really small voice.
Oh, that's right.
Right in the scene where she says, yeah. I don't like children.
Yeah, that's right.
There were
that's
no
right.
surprises like that in this one.
No, it would have been nice to have what I like to call the sort of inside baseball references, where like, you know, the people who get it will really enjoy it. Those little things like that. And this film, it's one of those straight down the middle, play it safe, special effects driven things. It doesn't have the cleverness to work in that kind of, and that would be an incidental detail, but I would settle for incidental details, little incidental pleasures, as we call them, just little things along the way to kind of perk us up as we're watching.
Yeah, like every now and then you'd get something like that. Like they'd have a night scene in the forest where the fairies are awake and doing things. And then you would be noticing, oh, that is a really cool fairy that's actually a dandelion.
Yeah, there were some, you're right. There were some, in some of those forest scenes, I mean, it really was like Midsummer Night's Dream type
yes,
material, wasn't
exactly.
it? Wasn't it? Where you had, you know, fairy dust, but also, you know, or the bar scene in Star Wars or something, but
yes.
just like all the menagerie, like all the different,
yes.
all the different fairy types, if you will. And some of those were kind of amusing, but again, they literally flit through for a minute or two, so they're not going to factor into the story, nor should they necessarily, but they're just like moments of where you'd smile watching it. So yeah, that's where you wanted them maybe even just to indulge that a little bit, just because those were pretty scenes. I'm not saying that in a pejorative sense. Those were like pretty
yeah,
scenes
they were.
To watch.
Really nice, fun to watch.
Yeah.
Now, I think it would have been a better movie had they focused solely on the fairy world, Maleficent post Aurora.
Oh, yeah.
And then
okay.
at the end, they can have her, you know, fly in if they wanted to end it that way where, you know, she's there for a christening. And that would also set up movie three.
If you were master of the universe.
If I was. Unfortunately, I am certainly not.
But you know what? Any future sequels could actually kind of incorporate that shifting of gears. You know what I mean? Like, rather than have these principal characters, focus on one of them.
Just one.
Yeah.
When they said Maleficent, Mistress of Evil, I expected more.
Yeah.
So that brings us to another, I mean, the reason we paired these together, the Addams Family with Maleficent, is it's sort of a blast from the past. Stuff that used to be for kids that is now being served up for kids of all ages.
And that is the Hollywood story nowadays, to constantly recycle pop culture. So when you said there probably won't be a third Maleficent, I said, well, never say never there, because things are constantly being, you know, reborn or revamped. I mean, this sequel for Maleficent, you know, 5 years later, somebody decides to revisit it. So I wouldn't be surprised if somewhere along the line it gets revisited again. And the Addams Family, of course, has been sampled so often. Ironically here, because it's an animated version, and not only that, but an origin story, how they got to be who they are and where they live and so on, that it actually does take us back to the origins, speaking of illustration, namely the Charles Addams cartoons mm-hmm. from the New Yorker magazine. So that actually was kind of sweet in a way, just as a reminder of what from whence it came.
Yes, I love those drawings. To me, it's like the cartoon version of, if Alfred Hitchcock was a cartoon, he would be a Charles Addams cartoon. That sort of dry, droll, demented,
well, think of the
dark.
The, as you well know, the profile that opens that Alfred Hitchcock presents. I mean,
yes.
where he is, you know, a caricature.
Yes.
Where you recognize him that way alone. And, of course, one of his most famous cameos was in Lifeboat. Because Hitchcock loved those cameos, but how to work it into, and he enjoyed a technical challenge, because in Lifeboat, they really are in a lifeboat in the North Atlantic. Hitchcock initially thought maybe he could float by.
Like a dead body.
Well, yes, because, you know, a ship has been sunk and, you know, the German U-boats and all that, and the survivors, you know, Tallulah Bankhead and the others huddled on the lifeboat, that Hitchcock thought he could float by like a whale or something, you know, he could float by. He thought that might be too distracting, right?
I think he decided he didn't want to get wet.
So why don't you tell the rest of the story as to how he worked himself into it.
Well, the way he works himself into it is he puts himself in an advertisement on the back of a newspaper for Reducto,
yes,
a weight loss scheme. And actually, he had lost some weight, so that was part of the reason he decided to do it that way.
It was sweet that way. But, you know, in terms of playing with caricature with that, I mean, that's always an issue for Addams Family. Whether you're doing it in animated form or live action, when it's done live action, of course, it is a live action cartoon. So it's always a matter of then how cartoonish, how over the top, how overstated to make it, and when to underplay it. And where they've been blessed here, I think, is, well, the original TV show, spot on casting. The Barry Sonnenfeld film versions, the live action film versions from 19... 19- 1991 and 1993, Raul Julia and Angelica Houston, spot-on casting. And now for this version, spot-on vocal talent, if you will. Oscar Isaac as Gomez and Charlize Theron as Morticia. They've been blessed, in whatever iteration we're talking about here, they've been blessed with like really good talent, whether full-blown acting talent or vocal talent. They're getting the right people here. And that makes a difference, because imagine how it would be if somehow a voice was off. Or the physicality of it in live action, if somebody didn't quite look the part, it would be so distracting, because we all know those iconic images. You would never adjust to it. You'd be bearing a grudge for all, you know, this is an 87-minute long film. You'd be bearing a grudge for all 87 minutes in a case like that, right? You gotta hit it head on. And speaking of hitting it head on, this film plays it safe in a lot of ways. It really sort of straight down the middle what you'd expect in terms of an origin story, how they ended up in a particular New Jersey neighborhood, how the neighbors welcome or don't welcome them, and so on. I was reminded of a much better film, actually, Edward Scissorhands.
Me too, with that spooky castle at the end of the street and the ricky-ticky neighborhood where everything is
Think of the Tim Burton
Levittown.
Yes, it's all like a Levittown, and Tim Burton is always great with production design. And when you think about in Edward Scissorhands, the spooky haunted house on the hill, which is an Addams Family house on the hill, and then the cookie cutter suburban neighborhood down below with characters, it's kind of a timeless thing. They seem to be like mentally trapped in the 1950s or something. That sense of timeless suburbia, and how they're so conformist that of course most of them are going to reject, you know, whether Edward Scissorhands or the Addams Family, just for looking the way they look. And of course, this is a planned community in this version of the Addams Family, and it's known as assimilation. That's the name of the community. And so ultimately, at the end of the almost 90 minutes, it's that very predictable reconciliation and happy ending, namely of learning to accept people and love them for what they are. And I'm thinking, okay, it's an Addams Family greeting card that way. And you know, I realize like at a certain tender age, I would have needed to hear that lesson for the first time too. By now, I feel like I've heard it a few times, and it's reasonably agreeable to watch, but you know where it's headed, and it indeed does head there.
Yeah, the likening it to Edward Scissorhands is really right on the money for all the reasons that you mentioned. And even also, you know, having the like HGTV kind of joke in there instead of the Avon Lady thing.
Yeah. You know, that's an issue for a film like this. To what extent should it even try to be somehow topical or of our time? That's a tough one, I think, conceptually. Like, do you want to just have it be the Addams Family and sort of frozen in cultural amber that way? Or can you work in jokes that you know, tap into things that are more recent, more current for us? And I'm sort of two minds on that one. I mean, if it works, it works, of course. But as to whether you're better off just playing it timeless, or should you try to juice it with contemporary references?
Now, the character designs in the family are directly inspired from Charles Addams.
Right.
But Gomez and Morticia resemble Hollywood celebrities Peter Lorre and Gloria Swanson.
Yeah, they do. They do. And it works. I mean, they're close enough to what we expect and demand of Gomez and Morticia, right? It doesn't veer radically from that. But you can see those other actors being referenced. You can see that play in. And it works because you know, Gloria Swanson always was that kind of vamp. She always had that image that she projected. So no problem there.
Other places you see references to Charles Addams.
Yeah.
The family moves to Westfield, New Jersey, which is where he grew up.
Right.
Also, the Chaz license plate, CHAS. That's how he used to sign his work.
He would sign the cartoons that way. Yeah, yeah.
They also changed. Wednesday has a pet octopus named Socrates in this film.
Okay.
In the Addams Family, the 1964, the pet octopus was called Aristotle.
Okay.
And it was owned by Pugsley.
Okay, a radical revision.
I know, radical revision.
We'll be up in arms, picketing the theater. How could you change that?
I'll say that my favorite part of the movie was when Thing was looking up porn on a laptop of feet.
Yeah, I know. I know.
That was hilarious.
That was funny. And the movie manages to retain its PG rating. I want to reassure you, it's good for the whole family.
Yes.
Particularly good for if you have a foot fetish or something. It's good.
I also liked the way the house kept telling him to get out. By the way, that's the same voice as Lurch. Until it had its coffee, which you put it in the house by flushing the coffee down into the plumbing, which I thought was
brilliant.
Yeah,
that's how it's done.
That's how it's done.
That's how it's done. No, and it actually is a sweet idea to have that personification of the house itself, because it truly is a character, right?
It is.
In any version. I mean, having seen it also on stage, you know, it was the set design that really stole the show there. And so in the movies, one watches for that. And, of course, with an animated film, you know, the sky's the limit. You can do what you want with it that way.
Other nice things are like the Wednesday's braids made into nooses.
Oh, yeah.
That was a nice little styling.
That was a nice styling. And we should mention that Chloe Grace Moretz does the voicing for Wednesday.
Yes, that's true. Who else do we have doing voices?
Well, Allison Janney's the one we should mention.
Yes.
She plays like the homemaker who's the community leader up in arms quite literally there. And she's going to, you know, it's a variation on all those stories of where, in this case, not the peasants with pitchforks and torches, but the community association up in arms. They're going to charge the hill and, you know, force this family out. But she does a good job with it.
It's also sort of a reference to the Peg Bundy character that they have in Edward Scissorhands.
Right, exactly.
With the bright orange hair and
exactly.
the vibrant clothes who gets her revenge when she doesn't get her way.
You know these filmmakers have seen Edward Scissorhands. You absolutely know they've watched it. I mean, the parallels are almost uncanny there. The co-directors of the film, Conrad Vernon and Greg Tiernan, whose previous film was The Not Very Promising Sausage Party.
I mean,
how do you go from that to the Addams Family? Well, they did, and good for them. But imagine that resume. Those is back-to-back credits. Am I versatile? Well, I directed both.
Yeah, just leave Sausage Party off.
I've never used it in the classroom, I want you to know.
I haven't either. How strange. Great line where Morticia says there's usually a murderous clown attached to the end of balloons, which is obviously an homage to the horror story It.
And clowns are always being bashed in cinema. I feel sorry for anyone who does that professionally. Go on.
Well, also the voice for Pugsley Adams, Finn Wolfhard,
right.
Starred in the 2017 adaptation.
That's right.
So,
that's right.
You know, way to bring that in. And I did love Snoop Dogg as Cousin It.
Yeah, that was
good. I laughed every time.
That was funny. I like that. I like that.
And I did think that the joke about the school being a prison for children was really pretty funny.
Yeah, funny and sad.
Funny and sad. But everybody went, oh, wait. Yeah, it is kind of like that.
Yeah, exactly. So it touches base with enough real-life concerns and situations. And of course, even the original one in its daffy way would do that. The fact that, you know, these are idiosyncratic people, to put it mildly. And it's all about accepting us for, you know, what we are and how we look and so on. And so that was always, you know, a large part of the appeal of the original TV show, you know. And prior to that, of course, to the Charles Addams cartoons, which were exceptionally well drawn. I mean, they're really, if you look at them that way, they're really... he has an economy of line. He doesn't waste line at all, and he uses it really well there. And he created his own world. I mean, you know, the fact that we're seeing all these iterations of it, television, a few films, I saw it on stage, I mean, all these things, and it still works.
And, you know, those cartoons also work mostly without any words. Like one of his most famous ones is an empty bus.
Yeah.
And you see the bus driver looking very alarmed because he's just passed a cemetery. And that's all it shows, but you realize somebody has probably pulled, you know, I want to get off at the next stop right there at the cemetery. So all of that's conveyed with that real economy of line.
Yeah, economy of means there that, you know, you're working with just that single strip in the cartoon. And you just don't want to waste anything. So between the simple line drawing and just either a line or no lines at all of dialogue there, that carries it. That's the ideal, actually, when you can just let it tell the story. It's sort of, you know, an analog to in silent film, where if you could get the image with just the right composition, you don't need a title card. You don't need dialogue or anything there. Just
and then you can export it as is.
Well, that helps, too, pragmatically, sure. I mean, that the image carries it that way. And Addams Family, that's why it has played through all these iterations and plays well to all kinds of audiences, because we can all relate to that basic storyline and the basic message. So, yeah, it's very predictable, and we've heard it many times before, but it was agreeable to see again.
I did see it in 3D, but I will say that I didn't really think that they did anything all that interesting with the 3D.
I must confess I also saw it in 3D, only because it was the only available showtime.
What did you think of the 3D?
Nothing special.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Which is kind of too bad.
So I'm swearing it off again.
Yeah, well, I like 3D, and especially when you've got stop motion, you do have an option to do something really creative and interesting.
Well, that's true.
So, but I would do you think that there's an option here for any any aspect of this movie to be nominated for anything?
Again, I would think only perhaps in some of the what we call craft categories. Otherwise, I don't think so. I mean, it opened modestly, and it's a story we've all had so many times. There's no particular reason to single it out for award recognition, really.
How about bringing in a new generation of Addams Family fans?
Well, that's actually because of the rating, the PG rating, it really is designed for families with small kids, and I think it plays well there. So, yeah, for somebody with a really small kid who doesn't know the history we've been talking about, it's a great gateway Addams Family film.
A gateway drug?
Well, without the drugs, though.
Without the drugs. Yeah. All right, so we would like to thank you for listening to today's show, and also to be sure to listen to this podcast and all of our podcasts on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we will see you next time.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.